Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Senior Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Michael Schnurr, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Lynchburg. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, very much. Very excited to have you on. Certainly a lot to talk about here, and you know, it's always interesting to hear from folks in the academic profession to really provide some of the framework for, you know, how and why, you know, some of the challenges in the market and what's going on with the economy at large really kind of do exist. But perhaps to start, you could walk everyone through a little bit about your background and what you currently do.
Sure. Background, I was with the Nassau County Police Department. I was a bureau commander there. Part of my time I spent doing asset forfeitures, working in the legal bureau and identifying illegal gains, you might say it. And while doing that, I finished my degrees up and went into teaching. Presently, I'm at the University of Lynchburg. I teach economics and finance over there and a little business law, and enjoy it. On top of it, I do the I coach the club lacrosse team, and I run the student managed investment fund. So it gives me a little time to interact with the students, which is what the enjoyable part is.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, currently at the University of Lynchburg, what is everyone doing in terms of in-class, virtual? How has that kind of evolved and changed over the last couple of years?
Well, obviously, we responded as the rest of the schools. They went to a hybrid as COVID first hit. We, you know, we're doing everything online. Then coming back in the fall, strict mask mandates, limited classroom sizes. And we did go into the classroom, which I was glad about. It was a little easier to do. But masks wore well on through until last semester. And then finally, now we're back to normal, we hope. Hopefully, we don't get any changes in what happens before the fall comes around.
And in terms of, like,
see the faces.
Was there any evidence that, you know, the change to a virtual environment, you know, had an impact on students' testing scores or anything else that you kind of really could equate?
Not so much testing scores, but the interaction, you did see the students sort of stepping back, not interacting as much, even on some of the outside activities. You know, well, I said I coached club lacrosse team, a little less involvement. So it just seemed to be a little less active within the classroom outside. Test score-wise, I think they still had the incentive to study and get the work done. And I guess sometimes I have to look inward, you know, as teachers, did we keep it up? You know, did we let down at all? I found myself, you know, I guess mentally tiring more, no good excuses for it. Just, you know, you have to look at yourself sometimes. Can't always blame the students. Sometimes you have to look in that mirror.
And then, you know, when you think about, you know, kind of, you know, teaching during periods of this market volatility, you know, how much of this, you know, knowing that, you know, the macro backdrop has deteriorated, how much of this is, you know, theoretical, or do you kind of pivot some of the curriculum now to kind of really talk through real world challenges that are currently happening involving, again, in real time, right in front of the students?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think, you know, sometimes we do get, I don't want to say lazy, I'll be picking on myself, but we tend to use textbook too much. And I, you know, especially taking inflation out for years, you know, we taught it, we draw a graph on the board, demand pull, cost push, but there was no inflation. From an instructional standpoint, it's been great, because you get to walk into the classroom and say, this is really happening. As you said, you know, my classroom, we have the Bloomberg terminal, so you get to bring up a lot of data, and you try to do the best you can to use the real world, you know, what you're in. You're in the real world, and sometimes academics push into that theoretical world. You have to fight back, because you hope you're training students to do financial work that they're planning for. So more and more now it is becoming real world applicable. You know, we can show this is happening, let's forecast, you know, are they going to raise rates? What's the implication of it? So I think this has actually made it much easier to bring the real world in versus, you know, read the textbook, put a PowerPoint on the board and give a test at the end of the day.
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of folks on, and I know a lot of people, you know, read quite a bit around, you know, where they think inflation is going. You know, the things like inflation expectations, which still feel fairly anchored, despite the fact that we've seen really high current backwards looking prints. But kind of maybe to start off with more, maybe a little bit more of the theoretical and kind of what how the textbook teaches inflation and maybe what one would expect given the dynamics, you know, what are some of the big drivers or potential drivers of inflation? And then kind of how has that really played out so far in the real world in terms of, is it supply driven? Is it demand driven? How is that balance sort of played?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's quite complex, which again, from the structural standpoint, is great. You know, we're turning back to Milton Friedman, always talked about excessive money tends to be the driver for inflation. And, you know, we did hit the COVID point with, we can debate how much they've paid out. And again, we'll, in hindsight, we'll come up with that. You know, we turn to the Federal Reserve Bank and say, all right, are they going to take care of inflation? But at least on paper, they're designed to the demand side, not the supply side. We've been hit with both here. We see a strong demand, which is great for the economy, yet now we're talking recession and, of course, the supply chain problem. So, if you can picture, you know, here's demand increasing, pushing up inflation, but due to various aspects, oil, an example, we see supply shifting back. So we actually have both components taking effect here. Increased demand pushing up prices, supply chain problems and other cost problems pulling back on supply. So as we start to look at it, we saw, what's the Fed going to do? You know, should they raise rates to fight inflation? Well, again, that's the demand side. But how will those rates impact supply? So right now, we're really getting a double-edged sword here. We're hitting demand and supply and talk of recessions. Do you raise your rates going into a recession? So they're going to have to decide this between a recession. We just saw an inverted yield curve, which is a precursor to recessions. Do we take care of the recession first? So there's really a lot of pressure on the Fed and the fiscal policymakers, and I'd have to pick one. And right now, I think they're probably going to go more for the inflation side than the worrying about the recession at the moment.
So when you do kind of break it down in terms of things that the federal government can help influence, you know, you mentioned quite a bit, especially, you know, with the Fed around the demand side, what levers, if any, does either the Fed or even, you know, kind of the government at large have to influence and impact supply?
Yeah, on the supply side, you know, especially now we're global, we had much more control 20 years ago. So we were the big guys in town. Well, now our policies, excluding tariffs, really don't have as much impact on the foreign supply side. You know, we saw, you know, our ports, for instance, are a little behind right now just because the ships start coming, can the ports get it off? And then, of course, the obvious, once we put them on the trucks to get them to the trains to move it, we have the gas side, you know, high cost of trucking. Can they pass that over to the consumer? You know, we bring up an economic statement, you know, inelastic versus elastic. You know, if we're inelastic supply, something we need, well, they can pass the prices on to the consumer and there's your inflation. If they can't, well, that's going to be the hit on the business side. And do they cut back on supply then? So we're seeing less control really over it. Now, we can deal with our domestic side, but we can't control the rest of the world. You know, we import. So we are looking at a problem there that, of course, we want to get rid of the tariffs on China now. That can be a political debate whether, you know, people feel we should or shouldn't. But at the same time, if we raise our rates, you're not going to see other countries responding like they used to, other than to affect the value of their currency.
And so when you think about it on the supply side, right, certainly, you know, I don't know what the growth trend was with where we are now versus where we were pre-pandemic. But for all intent and purposes, let's just say we got back to trend growth. Right. So we had a little bit of a dip and then all of a sudden we reaccelerated back to what, you know, our trend was over the last decade or so, or at least post global financial crisis. Why have we had such supply issues then? If essentially we probably would have grown into that had COVID not happened. What has happened over the last year that has caused so many supply issues? Is it labor shortages? Is it, you know, inability to kind of get or incentivize the right employees to the right places? How come the ports have struggled? You know, what are some of those factors there?
we haven't been putting our money into our infrastructure. And I'm not even talking about, you know, EV, the cars and so forth, but again, our ports, you know, they're really not up to foreign ports, for instance, our infrastructure on our rail system, roads and so forth. And the ability to move freight quickly and inexpensively has become a big problem. You know, I think another thing we're seeing is we've expanded on the technology side on transportation. If you look at the LA ports, it's technology driven now. Do we have the skills? Have we been teaching the skills in schools anymore? Now, again, we're looking at the textbooks. So I think a big component we're looking at is our workforce skill level. Not that we don't have an intelligent workforce. Have we given them the skills and the tools to move forward with what they need now? Just, you know, if you look at the finance area of algorithms, what you're doing right now, the ability to have a vast knowledge of economics, at the same time, be able to sit in front of a computer and use communication skills. I don't believe we've kept up with the times. So it really is a skill set on our labor force.
And does that also kind of speak to explain some of the lack of investment, especially in energy production domestically here in the U.S., where it feels as though, at least things that we've read, where petroleum engineers, the overall, you know, rate of those studying those disciplines is plummeted. And, you know, where are they going? Probably into things more exciting like crypto, whatever else it might be. But there's also just a lack of folks that allow for, you know, again, that investment, maybe that would make a lot of sense right now, given where the price of oil is.
Yeah, I know we saw that way back in the 70s when nuclear engineering was the hot topic, and all of a sudden we decided not to use nuclear. And here you have a nuclear engineering degree, which obviously a fairly intelligent person at that point, what's their career path? And so you're 100% correct now. You know, not only do we go into, you know, are you going to take petroleum engineering as a degree, but just the petroleum and or the energy industry, are they going to put their money into it? We know they're not. If you're going to close the pipelines, let's say, well, why would I put more money into my particular infrastructure on the energy side? You know, we're waiting to see, you know, does solar work, does wind work? But, you know, it's really still in the infancy on that stage. Whereas the set ones, let's say, of petroleum, we're not seeing the money spent on it anymore, understandably. And if you look at the automotive industry now, obviously they're moving towards electric, which would be great once we get it. But are they, and it's more of a question than a statement outside my field, are they putting any more time and effort into a more efficient gas-driven car? Now, they're saying, fine, yeah, this is over, let's move on. So we can sort of see a slow growth in the technology side of gas-driven cars too.
And you know, kind of to put a bow on this whole conversation, we talked a lot in, you know, maybe a little bit less from like Wall Street's perspective, maybe a little bit more on the consumer perspective. So much of inflation is actually expectations and also kind of perpetual and self-fulfilling in that sense. So, you know, the Fed's come out and been very hawkish and trying to let everyone know that, you know, they shouldn't expect inflation to run wild. But really the big concern are these spirals where everyone believes that prices can only go up. So therefore, it kind of self-perpetuates that way. What is that phenomenon and how do you kind of curtail it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Well, back 8 years ago, I wrote a paper on expectation, but it's more on the global side. You know, so again, since we can't be so centrist that we're the only ones anymore. We have to look outside our borders. And you're right. We have what we consider very short-term memory. And now, especially the younger generation, this is their first run at inflation. Now, we really haven't had any since the 80s. And we do assume, and it's a terrible word to use, that's what the future is going to hold. So the only thing the Fed could do is really pull the Paul Volcker and just go after inflation tremendously, you know, raising rates, cutting back on supply of money. And that can be quite detrimental right now. And that's what we were talking about before, that trade-off. I mean, you know, are you willing to have high inflation to keep the economy going? Or are you willing to lose your job just to take care of inflation? The transparency of the Fed is so important, as you said. You know, they're saying we're going to go after it. The question they've run into this problem for what they changed their mind now. We're seeing the inversion of the yield curve. If they raise rates to fight inflation right now, they're really going to invert it more. You probably would see, as a 2 year goes up, we'll see the 10-year plummet. So we do have a problem now with the short term idea of inflation expectations. One way we solve it is to have a recession.
Yep.
And I don't know how many of us are volunteering to give up our jobs for that. I know I tend to be holding on as much as I can to my jobs. So it really is becoming a problem. The spiraling inflation doesn't just go away. I said, you know, if we see demand slowing and we can cut back towards a recession a little bit, hopefully they talk, you know, it's about that soft landing. that would be the only way to really stop it in the short term right now.
And in terms of problems that the Fed can control, or at least like how they, how you think they might stack rank their opportunities that they need to solve for, you know, it seems as though just going one and two, they would rather solve inflation than deal with growing the economy at this point. It seems like that, that at least at present feels fair. I think some of that, and I'm curious your thoughts, might be the fact that inflation, for all the reasons we discuss, you know, can get out of hand much quicker. But also there's risk to inducing a recession, especially to a point where, you know, again, if expectations start to change, people are going to do less investment if they expect things to continue to get worse. And that too can be a downward spiral. So how do you think they weigh those two outcomes?
Well, as you know, we have the dual mandate. Congress is trying to add a third, but we have the dual mandate of price stability and full employment. And primarily, historically, you know, the Fed's taken on the price stability, inflation, and let the full employment lead to the fiscal policymaker, understandably, you know, who gets elected. And I, that's why I think they will go back to it. They're going to deal with the inflation side. One, they're very asymmetric. They can deal with inflation. Now, they can take the foundation out from the economy, bring inflation down at a cost to the economy. What we're finding is, though, they necessarily can't get the economy going. So it's much easier for them to say, let's deal with the inflation. If we turn to get this economy going and fail at it, there's going to be some retribution on that. So you will see them dealing with inflation first, and they're going to leave the economy to the fiscal policymakers right now. And that's been historically how they dealt with it. So again, Volcker, you know, with the blessing from President Reagan, say, I'm going after inflation. You're going to have some problems on the fiscal side.
And so kind of with that, right, like, you know, we see number of job openings that are at historic levels, although slightly down month over month. I think it was like 11.5 million or so open jobs. What's not squaring away here? You know, how can you have that many open jobs? We've seen for the first time in decades real wage growth, or at least nominal wage growth for employees. All this seems to imply that, you know, there's still a lot of investment going on, yet people are doing so with a backdrop of knowing that the Fed has to solve for inflation, which would lead most to believe that there's going to be some economic pain coming going forward.
And that's been something we've been investigating, because on the assumption, again, I use that word too much, I guess, on the assumption that there is the availability of labor. We know they're looking. We see the help wanted signs. Of course, we're talking about what level, what pay scale, what skill level they're talking about. And the question of people, if we have the available labor, why aren't they taking the jobs? And two, how are they affording not to take the jobs? And I think the positive, though, is if we do go into a recession, we know that there are available some. Some will go away, but we have enough left over there. I've really been finding it hard to believe. We know, as you say, you know, the nominal wages are going up. You know, for real wage, we'd have to see, depending on the job. But you're definitely at a loss if you're sitting home. And I don't really have an answer to why aren't people going back to work that all looking for a job, because now with inflation, that's even more incentive. Even though your real wage might be slowing, the cost of just living, going to that supermarket and spending instead of $100, $140, and of course filling up your tank instead of $30, $60. So I think you can almost look at it as a positive. If we hit a recession, there might be some available jobs to go to versus in the past where we saw the sudden increase in unemployment and no jobs available. What you, the negative from a labor economist standpoint is the skill set. Again, if they're out of the workforce for 2-3 years, tough to get back in. You know, as you know, technology changes on a daily basis. I would have a hard time working a cash register right now. I don't think I'd get a job doing that. So somebody is away from it, it's going to change for them. So it goes back to that skill set again. I don't know why, though, we're not filling the jobs, other than people might be saying, you know, it's not worth it because, you know, unemployment runs out. You know, you can't just live off that. So we're really not seeing if we're going to have a sudden rush towards jobs, especially if there's a look of a recession coming. I think then you'll start to see a little panic on the labor side.
So kind of getting back to wage growth, right? You know, we saw a lot of wage growth last year, and we can talk about nominal terms, which means, you know, it doesn't take into account growth relative to inflation. We saw quite a bit, and it seemed like for the first time, as we mentioned, there was real wage growth for workers, you know, especially with the backdrop of cost of living and all these other expenditures growing, you know, for decades against their favor, wage growth had been, you know, a little bit less, hadn't grown as much. Looking forward and thinking about this, you know, now knowing that there is a backdrop of inflation this year that's been persistently in the high single digits, but also again, this backdrop of a potential recession. Do you see wage growth continuing to grow because employees are able to go to their employers and remind them of what inflation was over the last year? You know, maybe this is, you know, to start 2023, or do you think it's a situation where corporations start to suggest you should just be happy that you have a job, and for the one, and you know, to recorrect what had been one of the first times where employees seem to have a little bit of a negotiating power over the employers?
I think you're going to see it down at the lower income levels that they'll have be able to ask those raises. What's already starting to see some of the layoffs coming on the tech side. Now, I'm excluding the crypto side because, again, that they're being laid off because of internal problems. But we're starting to see, you know, some of the higher-end tech cutting back on employees because, again, as your wage goes up, that's great, but you have to be able to generate revenue for that wage. And we're going to start seeing the higher costs. We know it's going to lead to inflation. So as wages go up, inflation increases. But we're going to hit a wall, and ultimately you're going to start to see a cutback in the employment at those wage levels. And that's where we're going to see the problem suddenly, because it'll be a stagflation look, and then, again, the flaw comes out. So I think right now you'll see, and I don't want to say lower income levels, just to say at certain income levels, they will have negotiating power. See at the restaurants right now. But you're going to see at the middle and upper, and especially in certain skill sets, they're going to start the layoffs because they've overhired, and they're going to start to see it going back because they can't generate the revenue required to pay off on the higher wages right now. So that's that stagflation comes in. So we'll push up the inflation, and then all of a sudden we'll have the unemployment. I'm not stating similar to the 80s, but probably based on the same rules.
And so, you know, at the top of the show, you mentioned career earlier, you know, working for the Nassau County Police Department. And certainly that, you know, as well as your degree or work within the economics field has kind of, you know, allowed you to do some interesting things. One of the things that really stood out to me was what you do or what, you know, what you've done to contribute kind of in the world of asset forfeiture, right? So, you know, how folks are trying to circumvent certain rules and regulations, you know, again, for financial gain. Maybe just to start off, you could walk everyone a little bit through about your background in the space and also maybe some of the trends that you're really seeing here that stand out to you.
Yeah, well, briefly, back in the 80s, we identified using the U.S. Code, especially U.S. Code 2118, there was an ability to seize property that was generated through, and I'm going to say more towards the drug related. At that time, it was not just based on the normal crime scenario. So we were able to seize property and said, you know, the old, if you can take away the tools, they can't do it. So we, using the federal guidelines initially, and then states started doing it, we were able to do what's called asset forfeiture. So if someone generated cash from drug sales and we could tie it to drug sales, we could seize that and it would be used by law enforcement. If, let's say, you had a house and you were selling it out of your house, that was an instrumentality of the crime, we could seize the house. And this really started, and the other component of it is this could not supplant the budget of the police department. So it allowed to generate revenue for it. You know, little problems we had to be careful of course, was abusing a law. And we did start to see it. And originally, this is under the RICO statute where you're going after the big guys. And all of a sudden, we started lowering our targets. And next thing you know, you're getting the poor guy that, you know, he has $20 in his pocket and there's residue of cocaine on it. We seized the $20. We saw him sell up in a bag on the street. So it did become quite a profitable thing. I think it did work. The Medellin cartel took a good hit on it, but obviously with the resources they had, it had a minor impact on them, you know, back in the 80s, early 90s. It's still done, but they've gotten a little more restrictive. For instance, now, back then, we took everything federally. Now, states required to go with state law if there's one covering that issue. So it really became a great way to take the financial side away from the drug side. The question is, again, how far do you push it? How aggressive do you get getting, I'm not going to say innocent people, but let's just say this, the person that might have gotten something legally, and then we can tie it to criminality. But it was an interesting field. It was what really pushed me to take more, get my advanced degrees in finance and economics, is to learn more about the banking system, which is what we primarily did it in. Now it's definitely turning towards technology. You know, the big question is how much in cryptocurrency is used to launder money. Yeah, we can make up the number. We don't know. From what I've been saying, let's say about $8 billion in 2021 was the ballpark number of that. And that's, you know, it's up a lot from prior year, about 30% up in the estimate, but it's still a very small component of cryptocurrencies. So that's probably part of the new way, but as we've seen a price drop from 60,000 to 20,000, probably not the best investment for money laundering. So it's definitely taken away from, we used to have paper trails. You pick up somebody's 1099s, you look at the bills they paid, you could show they were spending more than they're earning. Now it's turned to the computer side.
And so how do you think that kind of resolves itself? How do you prove criminality, you know, with money that doesn't really have a trail?
Well, it really does. As you're aware, you know, as far as the blockchain component, but for instance, back in February, there was a couple laundered, trying to remember, about $4 billion, I think, they were able to get out of Bitfinex, I believe it was, Bitfinex. And the FBI was able to get $3.6 billion back of it as they were trying to launder it through the cryptocurrencies. So the question we have to decide is the amount of resources we have and the potential gain. How much time and money do you put into a Bitcoin seizure? You know, because again, it's expensive, it's time consuming. So you'd have to wait for something of this, of a $4 billion seizure, say we can go out and maybe get some of this money back. You're probably not going to see the feds put a lot of time into a, you know, $100,000, not worth their time and effort. So it's doable, well outside my expertise as far as the technology side, but we have seen them beyond identifying it. I think another thing that would stop from the drug cartels is, you know, when they did in the old days and hand cash to people, they know who they were giving it to. And obviously the retribution for stolen be quite severe. Now, you don't see the face on the other end. So we see more and more of the fraud occurring within different cryptocurrency markets. That itself could slow down the money laundering, because the drug dealers don't have control over it. They're not going to use it. So they'll, you know, I said, you know, I'm not going to say the $8 billion that we assume is in laundering is acceptable, but at the same time, you know, from a cost benefit analysis, how much time do you put into catching it? Sometimes just let it go. If it starts to exceed a certain estimated amount, then you'll see the Fed stepping in, I think, a little more aggressively.
Outside of crypto, what's the expected size of kind of the money laundering? And does it $8 billion in US or is that global? And then how do you compare that to kind of more traditional money laundering?
The $8 billion, it's on a global issue, since, you know, Bitcoin really is a national issue. It's something we've always estimated because you don't know the laundering until you catch it. To me, it's still a very small part of the overall money laundering. We're still doing assets. You can easily do it on any kind of commodities. You can do it on real estate and move the money. And, of course, cash is the other way. What you do is you want the layer. So they could turn around, for instance, and go to an offshore gambling site, take the cash, buy their, you know, the tokens to gamble, convert it back into money, and you have clean money. So that's just as easy to do it. What they have to do is called sort of smurfing. You really can't do it, you know, at $100 million at a time. You'd have to really cut the amount you're doing so it's not popping up on the boards. And then the other end is, you know, the how much assistance are you getting from the money managers? I mean, now banks, of course, we can hold a high standard. Are you going to hold an offshore gambling site or even certain money managers in Bitcoin to that high standard? Until you have, not only have regulation, but you have to be able to enforce the regulation. And that's where we're going to be weak for a while. You know, we can make all the laws we want. We do have the anti-money laundering laws now, but the enforcement's difficult because it's something, again, you can't always see. You have to, it comes from being reported.
It's incredibly interesting stuff. Michael, I want to kind of turn it back to you for any kind of parting thoughts or anything else that you wish we discussed that we didn't.
No, I was actually interested in on your knowledge, that way you understood the complexity of the inflation which we're facing now. And, you know, something I just try to look at every day, and I probably get more and more confused. I'm a very opinionated person usually, and right now in this, my opinions seem to be wavering, because as you brought out, you know, we have a demand side, we have a supply side, which one's going to take effect? And I guess I'm a little more worried on the supply side right now. I think we're starting to see some of the pressure coming down on rates and so forth. You know, even rates are odd right now. For instance, a 30-year jumbo mortgage is less than a 30-year regular, even a 15-year mortgage now. You know, we're seeing the inversion of the yield curve, which is precursor to recessions. Where that holds up, we'll see. But it's really gotten, you know, for people that study this or enjoy reading it, it's quite interesting. But I think the problem we might run into is a lot of, I'll call them newbies, into the stock market. This is their first taste of the downside. I know my student manager investment fund at Lynchburg, they've been doing really well in this upmarket. I want to see how well the students do down on the downside. I know personally, I was out of the market in October, but they know better than me, so they stayed in. We'll see how it works out for the newer investors.
So maybe that's actually a fair quick thing to touch on that we haven't yet. But so, you know, for those that don't know, for each incremental amount of risk that you take, you tend to be required to pay a little bit more in yield in the interest of borrowing. And some of the kind of proxies and comparisons that people make are, you know, a 30-year mortgage relative to a 30-year treasury bond. Recently, that spread has been very tight. Yes. However, right now, you know, and I know we got some new mortgage numbers recently, but, you know, you're seeing a 30-year mortgage at 5.25%, 5.5% or so. And the 30-year is about, you know, 3 to 3.25 or so. So you're paying roughly 2% more for a mortgage than you did a 30-year treasury bond at present. You go back a year or so, and I don't know the numbers, I don't have them right in front of me, but I'm guessing it was more like 50 to 125 basis points, or, you know, 0.5% to 1.25%. Why do you think that spread is growing, where mortgages are becoming more costly relative to treasury bonds over the last, you know, 3-6 months or so?
And you stated before, it's risk. You know, to take it away from more, let's look at corporate bonds. You're going to see corporate bond rates start to move up because of flight to safety. Ultimately, once we say, okay, we're going to have a recession, you can see the money flowing out of the corporates into treasuries. So you'll see the corporates go up, you'll see the treasuries go down, so maybe the short end. The Fed raises rates, all right, the short end of the curve will shift up, but you'll see that the notes and the bonds start to go down. So the spread between the corporates and treasuries will increase. When that spread gets big enough and we go, the risk is worth it now, you'll see the money pull back out of the treasuries and into the corporates, bring that spread tighter. So going back to that mortgage, the same idea. If the mortgage lenders have a concern about the economy and jobs, they're going to start tightening up. What I've been interested in following that jumbo, that has actually had the lower rate. So I hope they're not assuming that because, you know, jumbo tends to be the more affluent would be buying, because we saw what happened back in 2007-08, where the old fall from the AAA mortgages fell just as quickly as the subprimes. So basically, it's simply a flight to safety. And when the spread increases again, we'll see it flip around again. I think something interesting me to watch, though, is that if they raise rates and we see the 10-year go down, which I believe you will, welcome to the recession.
Yeah. Hey, bear flattener. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, thank you to all of our listeners. Remember to visit YieldTreat.com to learn more about our offerings. Subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. Thanks again, and see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to YieldStreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at YieldStreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.